In any high-profile case, there are dozens of binders. This is a personal binder. This wasn't in court. This wasn't evidence. This was something I did on my own time. Every day I wrote 2 to 3 pages, handwritten notes. It's almost 500 pages in this particular binder. This is a copy of that binder. The original binder is in the National Police Museum in Washington, D.C. They wanted it there, and it's displayed there in a case. During this trial, I knew it was going to be a high-profile case. There's going to be people with allegations. There's going to be problems with evidence. There's going to be questions. And most of these questions and these concerns will come up months, if not years, later. So you want a reference. I want my personal reference because I'm going to be involved in this. I want to tell people that this is what happened. Here it is. I wrote it down when it happened. Location, time, date. No question, because this is in my handwriting. So that's why I did the book. And in that regard, it was very successful. I did that. But again, this book is not evidence. This is for me. When I'm called out on something, all I got to do is go and find it here in the book, and there it is. So you ask, you say, may I go and check my records on that? And the court would say, yes, obviously. Binders that you see during the trial, and you see you testifying, the detectives may be testifying to it, are chronological records, essentially. And you are going back in time and writing down dates and times and locations and what you did as part of your investigation. Now the attorneys, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, they're gonna wanna know certain things, when they occurred, why they occurred, and where they occurred. So you go back to your chronological record and you can get it directly from there. That is official, that is evidence. That just aids the presentation when you get asked a question, because nobody can remember everything that happened all the time. It'd be impossible.
I know Furman had said they're bringing blood back to the crime scene where they're collecting blood. Really? What would anyone have Phil do then?
Yeah, the search at Rockingham continued, and I was back at the office trying to get the case together. It was at this point that my partner, after we got the blood from Simpson, he took the blood, which was secured in a vial, and which was then secured in a large envelope, signed off with seals on it, because there was a nonsensical argument that came out that my partner had actually put the vial in his pocket of Simpson's blood and was walking around with it, which is ridiculous. It didn't happen. The vial was sealed and initialed with a seal. Again, that vial was put into a large envelope. That envelope was signed and sealed. And Phil took that back to Rockingham and gave it to the criminalist, Dennis Flung, who was conducting his investigation at Rockingham, so that blood could be booked into evidence. And it would obviously have to be analyzed. It was booked into an analyzed evidence envelope. Blood, or whatever the evidence happens to be, when you have a criminalist, the criminalist is number one. They're responsible for booking the evidence. Phil can take the evidence to property and say, I want to book this. And they would say, okay, fine. It needs a DR number called the Visions of Record Number, which identifies it. Particular piece of evidence is belonging to this particular case. He would have had to phone that in and get a number. He could not have done that unless he's booking the evidence. They will not be booked without that number. The number could not have been obtained without the criminalist asking for it. That could be you. You could walk over there and say, I want to book the blood. Well, wait a minute, are you a police officer? No, I'm a producer. What are you doing with the blood? That's his job. Your job here is to do the show we're doing right now. Phil's job is to make sure that blood gets to the right person. That's just simple. Now, that's not his job to book the evidence. It's not his job to do any of that. The blood went to the crime scene because that's where the criminalist is. You can't take it in the office and leave it on his desk. So he brought that envelope to the crime scene gave it to the criminalist who took possession of it. The nurse drew the blood out, booked that into an envelope. The evidence went to Phil. Phil went to the criminalist. You have to be able to have this line of evidence and show where it went at all times. And that was part of linking this evidence that Phil completed. To do anything other than that would have, number one, been a violation of not only department policy, but would have caused real questions to be asked about real evidence. Again, this was a red herring, but a red herring exacerbated by someone who screwed things up so bad that they had to do one of these. It's them, it ain't me. It's simple as that. Blood, in my mind at that time, became the core of the evidence in the case. This was going to be all about blood. And that's what it became. And of course, Marcia Clark was going to be the prosecutor. And in a criminal investigation, once the district attorney, once you file a case, they're the boss. They take the case over. You essentially are their witness, but you also work for them. So our case now was to get results back. We did get some initial results back on the blood. Simpson alluded to the fact that he did bleed in his Bronco because we were finding blood in the Bronco. Initial testing, we found three different types of blood in the Bronco, O.J. Simpson's, and the two victims. Now he's a suspect in my mind. Eventually, we take the doors off that Bronco, we take the console out, take the windshields out, seats out, everything else. And we find more blood. We do luminol testing that detects blood that's not discernible to the human eye initially, the luminol testing. Come up with more evidence of blood. Take out the passenger. This is couple of weeks after. We take out the passenger seat and I notice a little light bulb that goes in the interior of a car, the interior light bulb rolling around underneath the passenger seat. And I look up in the Bronco and one is missing. Well, we find out that the one that's rolling around underneath the seat belongs up there. What is it doing underneath the seat? And I hearken back to when I was a young cop in Hollywood. It was in the 60s. We didn't have cutoff switches and that type of stuff. If you opened the door in an alley at 3 a.m., you'd illuminate yourself, and you don't want to do that when you're in a dark alley at 3 a.m. and you're stopping a suspect. So before we went out on patrol, we would make sure we didn't have that light. We'd pull out a little bulb. If it was there, we'd throw it out of the seat. What is this bulb doing under the seat in Simpson's Bronco? Come to find out it's serviceable, but there are no prints on it. But what's it doing underneath the seat? Well, he tells us he parked in the alley, but the alley is pitch black. 1994 Broncos, some models had cutoff switches for the interior lights, some did not. Simpson's model did not have a cutoff switch. So if you open the door, it automatically comes on unless you remove it. Did Simpson remove the bulb on purpose so he wouldn't be illuminated when he opened the door in the alley of Nicole's home? When he arrived, or did he not want to be illuminated when he left and opened the door? Is this why he may have removed it and threw it under the seat? Is this direct evidence of him committing a murder? No, of course not. It's circumstantial evidence that this could have happened, that this could be an intent. It's called intent. If you have one or two of those things, you can question them. When you got 15 or 20 of them, they begin to build. And this is what we have. All these little things are building. The cut on the finger, that particular thing, Denise's statement. Five pages of typewritten pages of little things like that, 20-something items we put together like that were never brought in the trial, including the statements he gave us, the inculpatory statements. Thank you. Friday, June 17th, Simpson was to turn himself in at the jail at Parker Center, downtown LA, to us. And he was going to be booked because we had obtained a warrant for his arrest for murder, for two counts of murder. He was supposed to turn himself in. That is not the way I like to do business, nor does my partner. We're used to going out and arresting people and doing all of that ourselves. The reason being is you don't want that person to flee. If that person knows you're coming for them, they wait, and they're wanted for two murders, they may just get in the wind for obvious reasons. You could also lose evidence if they knew you were coming to arrest them. We want to make that arrest ourselves and handle it ourselves. But we work for someone who tells us what to do, like any other bureaucracy. The brass wanted a show because it's a high publicity case. They wanted all this on video, so they went ahead and approved. Yeah, you can bring them in. We don't want to do that, but that was their call, so we go along with them. The plan was for his lawyers to turn him in, we would book him, and that would be that. Comes time to turn himself in, I remember he called, I think it was 11 o'clock. I called Bob Shapiro. He said, well, he was at the house and he took off. He took off with AC, and you know how he is when he gets this way, I can't control him, or something like this. They took off, we don't know where they are. He's in AC's Bronco. I said, AC has a Bronco? Yeah, just like Simpson. Took off in his Bronco. A lot of people to this day don't know that there's two white Broncos in Volunteer. We don't know where they are, they're in the wind. They didn't tell us where they were going. We don't know what to do. And so I said, well, we got a problem. Ported that in, so the LAPD puts their press people out and they say that he's a wanted fugitive. They make the release to the media to gasp him and all this other stuff. In the back of my mind, I say, where does someone like O.J. Simpson go, especially when they see Cowlings, who's now, you know, is he an accomplice to this? We don't know. Where did they go? We don't know. So I go back to my office and we're trying to put all of this together. And meanwhile, I hear in the back a couple of people, including a couple of the chiefs, have come down and they're concerned about what are we going to do now. And somebody yells out, OJ's on the screen, he's on TV. And I look up, we have a little TV in the corner of the squad bay. And we see the chase. Somebody looks like a helicopter has found his car, the white Bronco, AC's white Bronco. And they're following him on the Golden State Freeway. Apparently they're coming back northbound. And behind him, we see all these sheriff's units and highway patrol. Very slow speed for the, they look like they're going 25 or 30 miles an hour. All these police cars behind them. And they found Simpson. And now what are we gonna do type of thing? Well, he appears he's going slow, so maybe they can let him stop. So I'm thinking, now it's the job of whoever pursuing him to pull him over. Are they gonna do a pit maneuver? Are they gonna try to pull alongside of him? Is AC, who appears to be driving, gonna stop, pull over? Meanwhile, I'll be getting reports. We're getting direct reports from the sheriffs, Orange County sheriffs who are in pursuit in the highway patrol. They say that AC is in driving the Bronco. Simpson is in the back seat. He's sitting there in the back seat looking around, and then all of a sudden one of the deputies says, and he has a gun. So they tell that to us over the phone, he's got a gun, and I said to myself simply, shit. Now what are we gonna do? You got a guy wanted for two murders, he took off, but he's not in any hurry to get away from anybody, but he's got a gun. Okay, this changes everything. What are we gonna do? Well, you have to assume the gun is real, you have to assume it's loaded, but more importantly, you have to assume he's gonna use it. Well, how is he gonna use it? Is he gonna shoot himself? I don't know. Is he gonna shoot AC? I doubt it, but who knows? How about the cops that are right behind him? There's 10, 12 police cars behind him. He's going to shoot at them. He's going to shoot at the helicopter. I don't know. He's going to shoot at some of the people now. They're going so slow, actually running out of the freeway. banging on the windows, some of them, the closer they get to West LA. And more people were showing up at my desk, like, I'm supposed to make a decision here, and I don't know what we're gonna do, we're just gonna have to see how this plays out. You can't do this forever. And then all of a sudden it kind of hits me that we know he's got a mobile phone, but I don't have the number. So I called Patty Jo Fairbanks, who's the witness coordinator at the DA's office. She's got the phone number. So she gives me the phone number, and at least this is something. But he's not gonna pick up on his mobile phone. No way he's ever gonna pick up. So I call him and he picks up. He just shocked me, I didn't know what to do, I didn't know what to say. So I identified myself and I started talking to him. And again, my main thrust here was on the gun, and that's all. He sounds out of it. He sounds like he hadn't slept in a couple of days. He may be under the influence of something.
Jack, just let me get to my house.
Okay, we're gonna do this.
I'm ready, I'll give you whatever. I'll give you me, I'll give you my whole body.
Okay.
I need to get to my house.
Okay. We're gonna do that. Just throw the gun out the window. We're not gonna bother you. We're gonna let you go up there. Just throw it out the window, please. You're scaring everybody.
Later on, we find that he is under the influence of marijuana, that he's getting this moaning and groaning, and love to get this recorded, but we're not. All of a sudden, one of the people from the electronics unit runs in. They've got a tape recorder. Somebody thought this through, and the good thing, and they run in and they hook my phone up with a tape recorder. So now I'm able, the first couple of conversations I was not able to get recorded, but now I'm hooked up and I'm able to record conversations. Because hopefully this is gonna be some kind of evidence also. I tell him that, you know, tomorrow's another day, think about your kids, this is gonna end, you don't wanna do it, oh, yes I do need to do it, and all this other stuff.
Don't hurt everybody, you're gonna hurt everybody. Think about everybody else, all right?
I couldn't do it on a freeway. I couldn't do it in a field. I want to do it at a grave. I want to do it in my house.
You're not going to do anything. Too many people love you. Your kids, your mother, your friends, AC, everybody. You got the whole world. Don't throw it away. Don't throw it away, man. Come on.
In my mind, I don't know what he's going to do. But again, you have to assume that he's going to use that gun. So I, again, just talking about throw the gun out, put the gun down. You don't need to do this. Your family loves you. Your mother's worried about you. You've got the kids. We'll all work this out. There's an answer to all this stuff goes on and on and on. And now we find out that it looks like he's moving back towards West LA. And, oh, I just wanted to do that. I just wanted to be with Nicole. And then, well, later on, it's just, I just want to get home maybe and this, that, and the other. So we know he's going back to Rockingham, besides everybody's moving in that direction. So we let Metro know, which is SWAT, essentially. They have a SWAT unit. So we get SWAT to roll to Rockingham and set up because of the gun. If he ever goes to Rockingham and if he ends up there, SWAT will be waiting for him. When SWAT operates, they don't just park in front and wait for you to pull up. They conceal themselves, which they did, and they're very good at what they do. The problem is if he goes back to Rockingham and he gets out of the Bronco and he's got the gun in his hand, they're gonna shoot him. They're gonna dump him right there. They won't have a choice. So again, all I can think of is don't get out of the Bronco with the gun, leave the gun in, leave it in the car. Be better tomorrow, you're gonna be fine. Think of your kids, and all the stuff goes on until they pull into Rockingham. Media's everywhere. SWAT, I know, is set up. They pull in the driveway, and they're gonna beat him right on the Bronco and hope the guy didn't come out with the gun. And I tell them, leave the gun in the car. Don't take the gun out. Don't take the gun. Well, he's not talking to me now, but now he's put the mobile phone down. You know, I'm just talking to nothing. What is he doing? So this goes on for 2-3 minutes, all too long, way too long. Is he thinking of coming out with the gun or not? Is he gonna shoot himself? I don't know what he's gonna do. Meanwhile, just before this, Jason, his son, comes running out. He gets in at the AC, they're yelling at one another. A couple of cops run out, they grab Jason, they pull him back towards the house. And Simpson still hasn't gotten out. The tension is building. What's going to happen? Because I know SWAT is honed in on the Bronco. Well, the door finally opens and he gets out. And thank God he doesn't have the gun. He left the gun inside. He gets out and a couple of the SWAT guys come out and they grab him and they take him into custody. The whole time I'm wondering about what he's going to do now. Is he going to give us maybe an admission or confession of type? Are you going to do this one or the other? First thing they have to do is get him downtown to where we are. We'll see if what's going to happen from there. We have the warrants. Now he's obviously represented. He's not going to be talking to us even under these circumstances. But just getting away from this and subsequently what we find in the Bronco is very interesting, of course. Not only does he have the gun, which is real, which is loaded, but he has his passport. Why does he have his passport? He's got over $8,000 in cash. He's got his Hall of Fame ring. He's got his changes of underwear and socks. He's got a disguise kit. We find out the disguise kit was purchased in a North Hollywood store like 3 weeks before the murders happened. What does he know of the disguise kit? Mustache, little hair thing, and little chin beard. What is he doing with all this stuff? Was he really trying to escape? I don't know. We find out later when we interview AC that night. They headed down towards the Orange County to the cemetery when Nicole was buried, and they went to the grave of Nicole. AC tells us that when they got down there, he thought that Simpson was going to shoot himself because he had the gun. Later, he doesn't think as much, obviously, because Simpson comes out and they decide to get into the car. He doesn't know what they're going to do. They start back towards L.A., towards the Rockingham house. Because of the direction initially, we thought perhaps they were going to go to the border. But again, where's O.J. Simpson going to go? Everybody in the world is watching this thing on live television. He's not going to go anywhere, the bottom line is. Again, I'm not worried about this coming to a halt. It's just how it's going to come to a halt, and it becomes all about the gun. But we've taken care of that. He's in custody. He gets booked. We book him in custody downtown. He's thrashed. He's very tired. He's obviously hadn't slept in a while. And that's how that day ended.
On the way to McDonald's, did you happen to notice the time?
Yes, I did.
And where were you when you noticed what time it was?
26th and San Vicente, stoplight.
What time was it when it was, you got to 26th and San Vicente?
It was 9:15 and 9:18 was right in there.
How long after that did you get to McDonald's?
About 7 minutes.
Who paid for the food?
I paid, because he had 20, so I had another 20, so I paid for the food.
And did you hand that a second $20 bill then to the defendant to pay?
Yes.
So he drove and he ate his dinner at the same time on the way back to Rockingham?
Yes.
Did you notice any injury to his hands at that time?
No, I did not.
Or bleeding?
No.
What time did you get home?
About 9:45, around there.
What did you do when you got back to the residence?
I got out and went to my room to eat.
Did you see where the defendant went?
No, I did not get out of the cars.
And what time was it when you called her?
I called her at about 10:10, around there.
During that phone call, something unusual occurred?
Yeah, I heard a noise.
Now, how long had you been talking to your friend Rachel when you heard that noise?
It was probably a half hour into the conversation.
Okay, so about 10:40 or so, you heard a noise?
About that time.
Can you describe for us the noise you heard, Mr. Kalin?
So, like that.
For the record, the witness thumped on the witness stand with his fist.
Well, we went to trial, obviously, and there was a preliminary hearing in which he was held to answer. In a preliminary hearing, you need to produce enough evidence to hold him over into trial. in this particular case for two homicides, two murders. Not homicide, now it's murders. Murder is a homicide, but homicides aren't necessarily murders. I clear that up a little bit. Homicide is the taking of one life by another person. Doesn't mean it's necessarily a murder. But there are two counts of murder in this case. Held to answer at the preliminary hearing, so we get set for trial. Of course, this is a big circus. We can see that coming. This is a circus. What got to me initially and throughout the trial were two things, basically, that should have been done and that weren't. We just were no-brainers in my mind. It's a huge trial, a lot of publicity. No way in hell this judge is going to allow this thing to be on television, because it'll affect testimony, obviously. It'll affect the evidence. It'll affect the way attorneys act in court. It'll affect the way witnesses testify. So we're not, we don't have to worry about cameras in the courtroom. I knew the judge, Lancito, knew him as a district attorney. He's a very good district attorney. He's not going to lock cameras in the courtroom. Obvious, it's a no-brainer. And with all the talk going on, we'll get a gag order. No one is going to be able to talk about the evidence in this case unless it's produced. So we're in pretty good shape here. Well, guess what? I'm 0 for 2. I was wrong on both counts. It allows cameras in the courtroom, yet that allowed these defense attorneys to put on evidence before it had even been presented in court three times a day to the media who's waiting outside, attacking witnesses before they've even testified, influencing people, the media included, with this jury that was sequestered. And I don't know what that did, whether people thought that would work or not, it didn't. So they opened this up to the world and they allowed all this to be brought out to an open media, but they allowed the attorneys to talk about this evidence. So there'd be a gag order. Well, I was wrong there too. There was no gag order. Well, let me correct that. There was a gag order. There were two people gagged in this case, me and my partner. Nobody else got gagged. We weren't the ones talking to the media. It was the attorneys who should have been gagged. Cameras in the courtroom, testimony and evidence, the way it was presented. The gag order allowed all the stuff to go out to the media before it had even been presented in court as evidence. Two major, major mistakes in this trial. We knew we were on the road to destruction, and I spent 8 days on the stand. I had more problems with Marcia Clark on a direct examination than I did on Johnny Cochran's cross-examination, because I didn't know where she was coming from. When I went on the stand, I was supposed to address evidence and introduce evidence that the police did. Her ideas and my ideas about how much evidence should have been presented varied. Like I said, there were 20-something pieces of evidence she should have put on that she never did, that I should have been able to introduce. You never have too much evidence in a murder case. It's as simple as that. You put on everything that you have. She didn't do it. She had her own ideas on how to discuss this. When I was being examined by her on the evidence that she did allow in, the jury, which is from ADU, 6 feet away, 8 feet away, they have notes and pads that they can write all the notes they want. They were just glaring at me, not staring, glaring. They didn't like me. LAPD on trial, no doubt. Rodney King all over again, no doubt. Whether it was justified or not, we're not talking about that. That's what this was the LAPD on trial. The folks in the jury wouldn't be writing anything down as I was admitting important pieces of evidence, some of it blood evidence. Yet when Johnny Cochran was crossing me about where I lived in a racist LAPD and blood being contaminated and lying cops, they were writing like crazy. Again, those 8 days, I knew this trial, they were never going to convict O.J. Simpson. They did it all along. The prosecution had their game plan. They knew well that the LAPD was on trial. They were not going to rehabilitate LAPD witnesses, civilian or sworn. they get a chance to rehabilitate and recross. And they came back after the prosecution, after the defense dirties them up, they should rehabilitate those witnesses. They never did. They never put out all of this evidence. We can go over this in detail if you want. Is that a problem? 10 days before she was murdered, Nicole tells her mom, "My keys are missing to my house. When OJ was here the other day, I think when he came to visit the kids, I think he stole them off of the hook we had in the kitchen. I think OJ has my keys." Well, what we find in OJ's pack that he took off with at the end of the pursuit, this big black bag where he had his cash, underwear, Hall of Fame ring, the passport, the gun, the disguise kit. He also had a set of keys. It was the keys that Nicole thought that he took, which eventually he did. So why would he take the keys to the house if he didn't want to use them to get in the house? He didn't say he's a murderer. It didn't mean he's a murderer. This is inculpatory stuff that says, circumstantially, this is one of 20, 25 pieces of circumstantial evidence to say he may have an ill intent getting back into that house. We didn't see any of that in trial. Why didn't you not see that in trial? Again, because the LAPD is on trial. Marcia knew it. The other attorneys, I don't think they went along with this. This is Marcia's decision. She's number one seat. She's handling the whole show. It wasn't Chris. She made all the decisions to not put this on because she did not want to appear in bed with the LAPD. That's why you didn't see this stuff, because she knew damn well this jury despised the LAPD and it was the LAPD on trial. Now, if that's your strategy, I don't have a problem with that. I really don't. But tell me about it. Tell the rest of the people who are your witnesses what your plan is, because there's plenty of DNA evidence that could have found anybody guilty of murder in this case. The DNA evidence was overwhelming. Fine, but tell me if that's your strategy. She never did. She never rehabilitated me or anybody else if she could have. Again, there's never too much evidence in a murder case. You have so much evidence. Any seasoned homicide cop, when they get a murder case, they look at the evidence. It's very, very rare in any murder case to find what we call exculpatory evidence. Now, what is exculpatory evidence? We'll go back to the shoes. When I cooked those Reeboks from O.J. Simpson, and he told me he was wearing them the night of the murders, and I took them to size them, if they were size 10, that would have been exculpatory evidence, because we know we have size 12 left by the suspect at the crime scene. So those shoes that, by his own admission, belonged to him were not the same. That's exculpatory. If I'm sitting in the jury, I would say, well, he wears size 10 and there's size 12 left by the suspects. He couldn't have committed the murders. Well, that wasn't true here because those Reeboks were size 12. That's what we mean by exculpatory evidence. Most murder cases have exculpatory evidence. This case had none. This case had no exculpatory evidence of a substantive nature. There's a lot of supposition, but supposition is not evidence. Okay? Evidence is evidence. I mentioned that earlier. You didn't have anything like that in this case. Very, very rare. All the blood evidence went one way. You've got Simpson's blood and the two victims' blood in the Bronco crime scene at Rockingham. Everywhere. There's only three types of blood. The two victims and the one suspect. It's as simple as that.
Thoughts on Jill Shively's account and why that wasn't used?
Okay. Okay, Jill Shively was a young woman who was on her way to the Westwood Home Market the night of the murders. And she was traveling east on San Vicente, approaching Bundy.
I was heading east on San Vicente, trying to make it to Westwood Ho by 11 p.m.
It was about 10:35, 10:40 in the evening on a Sunday evening, the night of the murders. She sees a white Bronco come out from the right side off of Bundy. She later identifies as O.J. Simpson driving, nearly runs into her.
And as I'm approaching Bundy is when I almost run into O.J. Simpson's Bronco. I would have probably seen the Bronco sooner, but there were no headlights on his car. I swerved to the right of me to miss him. He went up onto the median. There's a middle median right there to avoid hitting me. And I realized to avoid hitting a gray Nissan, also on San Vicente, heading west. So he had kind of both of us cornering him in. I'm staring at this person at the time. I didn't know who it was. And they're looking at me, glaring at me, as if I had done something to them.
He yells and screams at her, something of this effect, and almost ran into her. I believe she said he went through a red light or something, or thought he'd gone through a red light. And she recognizes him. And when this happens, they exchange a little exchange, and then Simpson drives away. But he drives away, she gets the license number of his Bronco.
So as I'm looking at him, he sticks his hand out of his car and yells at the Nissan to move, move. So they moved three times, going the same direction. OJ would back up, the Nissan would back up. Instead of going forward the opposite direction, finally the Nissan backed up and OJ's Bronco took off north on Bundy and his lights were still off. I remember seeing his brakes, tail lights, but his lights were still off. He didn't even turn them on. When he yelled, move, move, I realized who it was. It was OJ, because I had just seen the Naked Gun recent movie of him, and I recognized his voice.
Anyway, she calls in, calls this in, and one thing leads to another, and she turns out that she would be a witness to OJ Simpson fleeing from the direction where the murders occurred. Again, this doesn't say he's the murderer.
I made the phone call to report him as a drunk driver before midnight. I remember it was before midnight when I called in. I looked up the number. It was like a three. I didn't call the 911, but I looked up West LA's LAPD phone number, and I think it was on Butler Avenue. And I called that number, and I called and reported him as a drunk driver. I know the last three numbers were 788. I can't remember if it was 3CWZ or 3CZW, but I said I have those numbers down. It was a white Bronco with shiny rims.
Even this is some pretty good circumstantial stuff. Two blocks from the murder, going through a red light, almost running into her. Pretty good stuff. I think you want to see her as a witness, right? Well, we don't, because she sells her story to Hard Copy for $5,000, which she doesn't even benefit from. That $5,000 goes to a lawyer who she has to hire to defend her from all these allegations.
Tom Lang was always good to me from the very start, him and Phil Van Atter. I loved them both. They were always my advocate. They stood up for me. They were always very good people. They stood up for me against Marcia a lot. And they couldn't understand why, you know, she wasn't using me. They had run every background check they could ever run on someone.
Marcia decides not to use her because she was paid for her testimony. I can understand that under some circumstances, but here you use her regardless, because it's very important. She's got him fleeing a murder scene. Besides, she wants cooperation. She corroborates her own statement because she took a license number from the Bronco. How else would she have gotten the license number, which is the same one, from the Bronco if she hadn't seen OJ driving the car? It's so obvious. It doesn't matter if she got $1 million for her statement. She still saw the car because she gave us a license number. She corroborates her own statement. Why in hell would you not use that? And there are so many other things. They're on the trial that they should have put on, the man at the airport, okay? This is another head scratcher. We're in trial, and I'm at a break, and I'm back in my office. I believe it's in May, March, I think in March. It's March of 1995, and we're in trial. We're on a break, and I get a phone call from a fella who says, I've been watching the trial. My name is Judas. Last name is Junis. I work downtown in the West LA area. And the night of the killings, he says, I was at the airport and I saw O.J. Simpson. And I saw him get out of a limousine. And when he got out of the limousine, I saw him standing by a trash container with a bag, and he's taking something out of the bag and putting it in the trash container. I said, hold on 1 second. The night of the murders, you saw Simpson at the airport? Yeah, he had a bag, yeah. Well, I'm aware of a bag because of Cato Kalin's and the limo driver, Alan Park's testimony regarding a bag that hasn't been seen since O.J. was left at the airport, that may have something in it that somebody could be interested in because of the way Simpson was being overprotective of it. That I got from Cato Kalin earlier before the trial, as well as the limo driver. I asked him, I said, where are you right now? He says, oh, I'm at work. I said, how far are you from the airport? He says, about 20 minutes. I say, right now, leave what you're doing, go directly to American Airlines. I'm going to meet you there. So, okay, fine. So I grab my partner, I grab a photographer, and we fly out to the airport, and he's waiting for us. I said, I want you to give us a walkthrough and statement now about exactly what you saw. So Mr. Junis tells us his wife works at American Airlines at the airport. He was there a little after 11 o'clock. He's parked in a small, low profile, I think it was an MG, at the curb. He's the only one around. Nobody else is around. He's waiting for her. The limo pulls up and pulls in front of him. And he's sitting there, there's nobody around, and he sees O.J. Simpson jump out of the limo. And then he sees the driver get out, come on, and a red cap comes out. And they start unloading stuff out of the car. He looks for his wife. It's after 11. And so he looks back around and towards the entrance, looking for his wife, who's working a little late, and she's running a little late. So he's a little concerned. He doesn't see her. And he looks back around. He's fooling around. He sees the red cap and the limo driver go inside with some golf clubs and a couple of bags. And Simpson is still outside. And Simpson is standing next to a trash container on the east side of the entranceway. Now there are two trash containers, one on either side, 44 inches high, four-sided, flat top. Four ways to put trash in there with a flat top. He says he had this little half moon-shaped travel bag on top of the trash container. And he removed something, he put his arm in the container, little half moon-shaped travel bag, and it looked to me like the bag was half zipped when he did it. And he's bringing something out, and he put it in the trash container. Now, real quick, when this happened, and Mr. Junis sees this occur, the bodies had not even been discovered. No one knew that the crimes had occurred. He's just seeing this Simpson putting in there. He's saying, so what? He threw trash away. He then sees him zip up the half moon shaped travel bag, pick it up, and walk on inside. His wife comes. He goes home with his wife. Hey, just saw O.J. Simpson. I'm like, fine. The next morning, it breaks, obviously, Monday morning, about the murders. O.J. Simpson's wife, and there was rumors about this, that, and the other. By now, the media has got a hold of the Browns, and I'm thanking God that I got a hold of them first, because the media is all over it. They got a hold of Judith Brown. Somebody from the media does the next morning. She talks to him, unfortunately. Yeah, I talked to Nicole last night, and she was at a restaurant having dinner and this, that, and the other. And so that someone from the media asked her something to the extent of, well, what time is this? She says, oh gosh, I don't know. She called here and she's in shock. And the media are asking her direct questions. Her daughter has been slaughtered just hours before. They're asking her questions. And again, I'm happy that I made that death notification first. She's saying, It was about 10:30 or 10:45, somewhere in there. And she called and said that she left her glasses there. And so we got a hold of the waiter there at the restaurant, and they're talking this, that, and the other about the glasses, and they found the glasses and all this. The media runs with this. They find out that Nicole was alive at 10:40 or 10:45 because she talked to her mother. When this happened, as soon as this comes out in the media, Mr. Junis heard this come out in the media. He gets on the phone. Who does he call? Not me. He calls the defense. He says, his name, he says, I was there and I saw OJ there. And he tells him the whole story. He says, I saw him with this bag. He put something in there. He says, I heard later that the murders must have occurred about 11 or 10:50 or so. So OJ couldn't have done it because he was at the airport just after 11. I just wanted to tell you that. Well, he was talking to a defense investigator who I happen to know, who's kind of two-faced, and I'll leave it at that. He says, fine, thank you, Mr. Jones. We'll be right back to you. We'll get right back to you. Well, you think they ever called them back? Hell no, they didn't call them back. Why would they? This is a prosecution witness. What was in that bag? We get into the trial. Mr. Junis is also watching the trial. He hears now about that there's a bag that Cato Kalin was concerned about that fits the description of the bag he saw Simpson stick his arm in, take something out, and put it in a trash container. He calls me and tells me all this. This is 9 months after this happens. What chance do we have of finding anything? Subsequently, we find out 9 months later, there are two common landfills, three pickups daily. What are the chances of us finding anything that may or may not have been into that half-moon-shaped travel bag? That's the same bag that Simpson had in the driveway at Rockingham that Cato went to pick up to put in the limo on his way to the airport. That Simpson, no, I'll take care of that. I'll take care of the bag, don't worry about it. We've never found that bag. Is anybody the slightest bit curious as to what Simpson may have been doing at the airport with his hand in a half-zipped bag, removing an item that Mr. Junis did not see and does not know what was, removing it, putting it into this trash container? And the bag never being found. I went all the way back to Chicago to look for this. But if I found other stuff in Chicago we can get into too that wasn't admitted into evidence. Do we want this guy's statement? Yeah. I go to Marcia. I'm all excited. I don't get excited much. But I said, we're in trial. Nobody knows where the shoes are, the Bruno Mali's, the knife. Bloody clothing. Where's all this stuff? I said, I get a guy, and I go through the whole thing. That's where the bag that Cato was talking about, the bag, Simpson had the bag. He probably took it to Chicago with him or dumped it somewhere in another container. But this is good stuff. Again, is this media's a murder? No. Do you want to hear this? What happened to the knife, the shoes, maybe? Bloody clothing? Marcia looks at me and said, well, yeah, but we can't corroborate it. At first, I thought she was joking. She wasn't joking. She says, well, it's a one-on-one. One-on-one? Yeah, but this is a guy that was there. He's a good witness. He's not a criminal. He's got no reason to lie to us. He saw the bag, and he saw Simpson remove something from the bag and put it in a trash container. Circumstantial as you can get, but so what? This, and with everything else, this is a really good witness. No, I'm not going to use him because it's just one-on-one. Real quick, going back, I think about 20 minutes ago, you alluded to a show I did 2 years ago about the evidence not used. And you alluded to Alan Park, the limo driver. During that show 2 years ago, it was just 2 years ago, I'm interviewing Alan Park. He tells me about his time at the airport. He says, yeah, he says, you know, we talked about that bag that Simpson didn't want us near, and that he must have had something in the bag, you know, nobody's ever found it, right? I said, yeah, right. And I said, you know, we had the witness that we interviewed about that, and she didn't want to use him. He says, yeah, I could never understand that. He says, because when I drove away in a limo, I saw Simpson standing there with the bag. I said, wait a minute. You saw the bag on the trash container with Simpson in the bag standing there? He says, yeah. And I said, Alan, did you ever tell that to Marcia? Well, sure, I told them. I told her all about it. And what did she say? She said, well, okay, but we're not going to use it, or something to that effect. There's your cooperation. It's not a one-on-one. Alan Park corroborates exactly what Judas says. They corroborate one another. You have a corroborating witness now to this very important witness. So she lied to me. She had Alan Park as a corroborating witness. It was not a one-on-one. You have this type of stuff, you want to use this stuff. I couldn't believe it. This is just 2 years ago, which is 28 years after this murder. I find out another thing that went awry and that should have used and didn't. Every time you talk to somebody, it seems that there's something else. This should have been used in the trial and never was.
Why was he over at the AC unit to bump the unit?
Oh, yeah.
If the blood trail does go from the Bronco up, so.
Good point. Right. Okay.
You said you have an air conditioning unit in the hole in the wall?
Yes.
Was it in the same wall that the air conditioning unit was in?
Yes.
Was it near the air conditioning unit that the thumb seemed to come from?
Yes.
And when Furman's interviewing him, he says, well, he's lying in bed. He feels a thump on the wall behind him. And he thinks maybe there's an earthquake. So he tells this to Furman. And when the limo driver shows up, Kito shares this with Alan Park, the limo driver. He says, do we have an earthquake? And Park says, no, I don't think the earthquake we had. So Furman goes back there, as he should. He did the right thing in going back there to see what could cause this noise back here. And he finds this narrow walkway that I described, which is pitch black, you can't see anything, and this huge air conditioning unit sticking out directly behind Cato's wall, where Cato's bed is. I mean, it's only inches away, but you'd have to go through the wall. And this glove that he finds is right beneath the air conditioning unit. Now, how did it get there? Again, I've told you what's behind this bungalows, if you were to walk on that walk all the way back. This is what I will theorize, and anybody can take it the way they want, but when Simpson returns, he's in a hurry. Obviously, he's in a hurry because he got a limo waiting for him to take him to the airport. He has things like at least one bloody glove, because we know there's a left bloody glove at the crime scene. He has a right bloody glove, perhaps shoes, perhaps clothing that he has changed. He goes upstairs and he does this really quick because he knows the limo's out there. He can see the limo through the Ashford gate when he enters, and he answers the phone when the limo driver calls in. He runs upstairs, gets his stuff together, and now he's stuck with a bloody glove, clothing, shoes. What's he going to do with this stuff? How about I dump it in the back where I dump everything else until I get back from Chicago late tomorrow, and I'll take care of it then. He goes downstairs with this stuff. He goes into this lot, and Simpson is a big guy. Big bone, husky guy. If you're gonna walk through that narrow walkway, it's gotta be very close because you're gonna bump into the wall, you may bump into the fence. It's dark. He can't see the air conditioning unit sticking out, but he's going down this narrow walkway. And he knows he's going to the end where I told you all the junk is, the abandoned wheelbarrow and shovels and tires. So he's walking with this stuff and he bumps into the air conditioner. Well, just on the other side of the wall, inches away, is Cato on the phone with his girlfriend. So he moves around, but as he bumps into there, he inadvertently drops the right glove. He gets stuck, I can't get through here. He doesn't realize he dropped the glove, otherwise he'd have picked it up, obviously. So he goes back out, he finds this little bag and he stuffs the rest of the stuff into the bag. That's where we get the bag from. And he takes that, again, he's in a hurry doing all this stuff. Probably doesn't even realize that he's dropped that glove. Now we know he's lost the glove at Bundy because he stopped and turned around and looked for it, and it's not on his hand, it's still bleeding. All of this stuff comes together. That's never put on. The timeline is perfect as to when this occurred. Jill Shively would have filled in the timeline perfectly. You didn't see her there at all. Because again, this is LAPD on trial. When you investigate a murder, because you file a murder case, it doesn't mean the investigation over. In fact, many times it's just beginning. This thing went on for months. We investigated this case throughout this trial, putting various things together, presenting them to Marcia to put on as evidence, thereby strengthening the case. Granted, it's all circumstantial. Circumstantial is good enough evidence. It's really good when you got 20 or 22 or 23 pieces of it with nothing exculpatory. This stuff should have all been put on. None of it was put on because Marcia realized this was LAPD on trial. She didn't do anything to rehabilitate much of the witnesses, such as Cato, who was a very important witness. In fact, she calls him a hostile witness and interviewed him under those conditions that he was hostile. He wasn't hostile. He was a very important witness to this whole case, and you saw him treated as a hostile witness. Somebody calls you a hostile witness, and you're going to act hostile. And that was all done terribly. She handled this terribly because her agenda, she knew what was in the LAPD was on trial. She didn't want to appear to be in bed with the evidence in the LAPD. So this is how she acted towards this whole investigation. Everybody else was a pleasure to work with. Chris did a very good job. This nonsense with the gloves and the gloves didn't fit. All comes down to it was another red herring. The gloves did fit. They're just not going to fit someone who's wearing latex underneath them. I don't care if you have the smallest hands in humanity, you're not going to get on leather gloves if you're wearing latex underneath them. There's also the shrinkage factor, and you don't let someone in front of a jury and 60 million people demonstrate that you can't get the gloves on. That was all handled very poorly. Again, that's the problem with cameras in the courtroom. That particular demonstration should have happened in chambers with the judge and the attorneys. Anyone with the slightest bit of common sense knows that if you have shrinked up gloves that are stiff and you are wearing latex underneath, it's almost an impossibility. In fact, I don't know how you'd get them on if you wanted to. In any way, it's ridiculous that that ever happened. So Chris was falsely accused. The only thing that he may have done differently is don't do it in front of a jury and a live television audience, because that exactly what would happen happened. I wrote a book called Evidence Dismissed. It was a bestseller, went all the way to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. I didn't want to write it at first, but an agent from New York came all the way out to try to talk me into it. And that's not what cops like to do, is talk about their cases. But when you're lied about, when you're used, when people lie about evidence that you found, when people falsely accuse you of things like racism, planting evidence, lying about things, such as the defense, some defense attorneys did in this case. You've got to do something, you've got to stand up. When a cop comes on the stand and pleads the fifth when he didn't have to, and rolls over, blames you, points fingers, you get pissed. I wanted my story put into print, and it was, and under Evidence Dismissed. Years later, I wrote a postscript bringing everybody up to date on nearly 20 years after the case. in the fourth edition of Evidence Dismissed. I'm as proud of that book, and I feel as strongly that book today, if not more so, because of all the nonsense that came out today that I did in 1997 when it was originally written. But I'm just glad that that agent talked me into writing that book, because that afforded me an opportunity and my partner to tell the real story about what truly happened in this particular case, the Simpson case. Because all of this is in there, and it's explained to the nth degree. I mean, we lay everything out exactly the way it happened. Well, as far as my perspective on humanity, I'm not bitter. I got bitter when I got back to Vietnam. I'll just say that and get rid of that right now. And that lasted for a while. But again, we're getting into politics, and I won't do that, but I'm very bitter of the way of that war and the way it was handled, and the politicians that caused it to handle, and to this day still are doing that. Pisses me off. You probably wouldn't understand, but maybe you do, because a lot of people are still around it. We're involved in that, but as far as man's inhumanity to man, it exists. It always has. There's a reason for that. Like, there's a reason for everything in life. I don't know what that reason is, but I respected my job. I'd like to think that I was doing something for humanity and trying to solve these things. I'd like to think I was on the right side of history in this case and all of the others. That's why I write the books. That's why I do these interviews, because I respect that. I respect the law. And I think sometimes people forget that there's a reason we're all here, and maybe they ought to give that a little deeper thought.